Les colloques du Collège de France.
I'm also very honored to be here. So I also have very many warm memories of STAN. So this is a meeting that we organized in Patagonia, and not only warm memories, also some cold memories from there because it was super cold. So I want to congratulate you three times for 20th, 40th, and 60th birthday. And it's always very nice to interact with you and to get some new inspiration for exciting experiments. So I would like to talk about the global neuron workspace. And for me, it has been a huge inspiration. So it dates back, I think, to Bernard Barres, who called it the global workspace without the neuronal. And this is the way he thought about it. This is from his book. And so you have all these local processors. I'm not sure. Yeah, so these are these single dots. And then somehow they come together. And the idea that Bernard Barres had is that they then form a global workspace. And this is how he described it. So it then somehow, this when they come together as a global workspace, there's this broadcast of a global signal. And that is the moment, according to Bernard Barres, that you become conscious. So this is a very influential picture from a paper by Stan Kasberg and Jean-Pierre Jeanjeau. This has been very influential and also guided many debates on consciousness. And so I would like to talk a little bit about how to think about this. So what you see here are these perceptual systems, memory systems, evaluative systems, the attentional system, and the motor system. And in the center then is this global neuronal workspace. So I want to talk about this and to see whether we can refine it based on what we now know. And I would also like to, towards the end of my talk about memory. So I would like to invite you to remember this number, 433. And so this is how we wrote about it, again, the same topic, the global neuronal workspace, in a paper that we wrote together and published in 2020, where we stated that the global neuronal workspace a hypothesis proposes that in the conscious state, a nonlinear network ignition associated with recurrent processing amplifies and sustains a neural representation, allowing the corresponding information to be globally accessed by local processors. So some of the topics you see coming back here. And these are the questions that I would like to address today. What is this ignition? What does it look like in the brain? What is the meaning of global access of information? Which information is globally accessed? And how does this work? What is the global workspace doing? And then I would like to illustrate the workings of the global neuronal workspace in perception and memory. And I would like to propose a few refinements to the original idea, nothing to be ashamed of, right? This is more than 25 years ago. But back then, the global neuronal workspace was really sitting in the center, in the core, and I would like to propose actually that in some cases it actually extends also to the periphery. So that is where some of these causal interactions take place. And the second modification I would like to propose here, we have on the right side this attentional system. I actually think that it's everywhere. So that is actually the mediator of the interactions. Okay, so we make this maybe the scheme a little bit simpler too. And this is what I want to discuss the idea. So the global neural workspace propagates attentional selection signals. And I'll first talk about perceptual systems. So this is a picture that is quite complex. And we should realize that if you see such a picture, neurons at early levels of the visual system, they have tiny receptive fields. And at first sight, they only seem to be caring about very local information, the information in their receptive field. That's not how we perceive, right? So if you direct your attention to the central zebra, you see that, for instance, this and this is part of the same animal. And what seems to be the case is that psychologists call this object-based attention. In neural terms, you see that neurons propagate enhanced activity when you try to bind all those features into one coherent perception. So if this is the picture that comes in, our visual brain creates this labeled representation. And that's the idea, that this labeled representation actually maps onto what psychologists call object-based attention, and that is actually precisely maps onto what is in your conscious perception. At least that's how I am thinking about it. Okay, so another picture. So first you have this feed-forward propagation of information from V1 to higher areas, from simple features to more complex feature constellations, as we also saw in Doris's talk. So here you can think of these nodes as the individual processors, the local processors. And then there is this sort of binding, this coherent activity. And for that you might even have special neurons that are then propagating the activity so that all the elements that belong to the same perceptual object are kind of grouped together, are bound together, are labeled, and become conscious. So that's how I like to think about it. So that then might go beyond what we call a global broadcast, and I'll explain exactly what I mean by that in just a moment. So this is how I like to think about it, and it's probably very controversial because philosophers of consciousness, they like to fight a lot also about terms. So for me, what people, including some, call access awareness is the information that we attend in perception. Then you have phenomenal awareness, that's the stuff that we do not attend, but that we could attend to if we wanted to, or if the task demands that. And then there are items outside awareness, because it's in the, for instance, if it's in the suppressed eye during binocular rivalry, and there are other situations. Okay, so this is sort of the theoretical framework that I would like to convince you of. Good luck to me. So I would like first to ask the question, what does this ignition then look like in the brain? And I would like to invite you to participate in this very simple experiment. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to present a dot about here. If you see it, please raise your hand. If you don't see it, don't raise your hand. So it's a simple task. 1, 2, 3. Yeah, that was easy. Now I'm going to make it more difficult, only for the careful viewers. 1, 2, 3. Nobody saw it. Okay. 1, 2, 3. Now it's doable again. Actually, there was nothing on the second occasion. But the nice thing is that for each and every one of us, there will be a contrast level where you sometimes see it and sometimes do not see it. And that is convenient because then you can look at the fate of these stimuli in the brain, which is what we did. Together with Stan, and we found actually something that resembles a signal detection theory, which proposes that if you present a weak stimulus, there is a cross trial, there's this distribution of what they called internal signal strength. So if you then present a weak stimulus, you're sampling from this green distribution. Now in the signal detection theory, there's also a threshold, and if the signal is above the threshold, you would say yes, called a hit. Sometimes, because of the stochasticity of the system, it stays below the threshold, so you say no, that's called a miss. On those trials without the stimulus, you would be sampling from a distribution shifted to the left. Typically, it stays below the threshold. It's called a correct rejection. And also because of the noise in the system, occasionally you would commit a false alarm. And we asked, where is this signal in the brain? And what causes this variability across trials? And what is this threshold? So we recorded from multiple areas, and I talked to Stan about it, and he said that's exactly what I predicted. So in his theories about the global neuronal workspace theory, he proposed that the information gets propagated towards frontal cortex, and actually that's what we started to support. And there the idea is that there ignition occurs, and if the activity reaches frontal cortex to a sufficient strength, then there a working memory is formed. And even if you then take the stimulus away, there's still a trace of the stimulus, even though you saw it perhaps only briefly. Okay, so, and the idea then was, according to the global neuronal workspace, on those trials where you don't see it, you don't report it, the activity is not strongly enough propagated towards frontal cortex, so there will be no ignition. And so we trained monkeys on exactly this task that you just performed. So in 50% of trials, there was a stimulus, different contrast. 50% of trials, there was no stimulus, and on those trials, the monkeys were supposed to make an eye movement to a dot that was always there, called a reject dot. On those trials, there was where they saw the stimulus, they should make an eye movement to where they previously saw the stimulus. And then we varied the contrast of this stimulus across trials, so if the contrast is high, they always see it, and if you then reduce the contrast, it drops, and we defined two thresholds, at 80% and 40%, and we said if the accuracy is below 40%, that's difficult. If it's above 80%, it's easy. And then in between, it's intermediate. And then we recorded from V1, V4, and also later prefrontal cortex of monkeys. And what we found was, for me, quite surprising. So here you see the different stimulus strength, so low, intermediate, high contrast. Now, per category, we made sure that the difference between contrast was absent. So it's the same strength of the stimulus. And what we saw in V1 is on those trials where the monkey was going to report it, there was already more activity than on those trials where the monkey was going to miss it. So this year the same stimuli. So that means that there's already some stochasticity in the signal propagation from the eye to V1, which I did not predict. So something other that I found interesting is that on those easy miss trials, so the monkey didn't see it, although it was easy, you get more activity than on the difficult hit trials. So that means that reaching a certain level of activity in V1 is no guarantee that this stimulus will make it into consciousness. Apparently, information can get lost downstream from V1 on its way to conscious perception. Before, it was quite similar. But in dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, we saw this bistable activity. Whenever the monkey was going to report, there was a high activity. Whenever he was going to miss, there was no activity. I mean, we were recording from an eye movement area, so maybe not so surprising. So there you can really put a threshold, so this would be sort of compatible with the signal detection theory. We also recorded from the trials in which there was no stimulus, and if the monkey correctly rejected, then we saw low activity. If the monkey reported erroneously that there was something, even though there was nothing, then we saw this ramping of activity, very visible in dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex. What we think is going on here is that there are actually quite abrupt ignitions, spontaneous ignitions, that happen at different time points in different trials. And if you then average, you get this slow ramp. And so if there's one area that would be compatible with the signal detection theory, it's clearly dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex. Okay, so based on what I've told you so far, where is the signal? Well, in this paradigm, apparently, it looks like dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, probably also other areas we did not record from. What causes the variability? There seems to be some variability in the efficacy of feedforward processing from V1 to higher brain areas. And the thresholds, probably the threshold, this bifurcation, so either the activity, if there's some level in dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, either ramps up and becomes a working memory, or it's lost and it decays. Okay, so much about ignition. And now I want to address the next two topics. What is the meaning of this global excess of information, and how does the global neuronal work system work? So now I want to kind of go beyond just this simple stimulus detection task. So I'm going to invite you to look at this stimulus. It's going to be only there very briefly, and try to see what is there. Okay, it's only going to be very briefly. So 1, 2, 3. Did you see it? What did you see? And some people saw birds. I guess some people saw brown and texture and other stuff. Maybe the very good lookers already saw the bird indeed. So there is a bird, but it's difficult to see. And the reason is that here you probably first have to do this incremental grouping process. So you first have to bind those features that belong to a single perceptual object. And in this situation, I actually think that the frontal cortex is not doing it on its own. It really has to reach back to early visual representations to cause conscious access. Okay, so this grouping by labeling I was talking about. This is another version where you need to group image elements. So here you probably see a square of one orientation on the background of a different orientation. Good friend and colleague of mine, Victor Lama, reported already 30 years back that neurons in primary visual cortex care about the difference between the figure and the ground. So if the receptive field is on the figure, then you get more activity than if the receptive field is on the background. And what's going on here is first the information is sent from the eye to V1. Here, neurons are only caring about what is going on in their receptive field. So there's not yet a difference between the figure and the background. V1 sends the information to higher areas that then feed back. And during a later phase, they start to see the difference between a figure and the ground. Okay, and what is interesting, what Victor showed already many years back, that if the monkey fails to see the figure, he probably sees the texture, but he fails to see the figure ground perception. And on those trials here in green, this figure ground modulation also does not occur. Okay, so apparently here we have a neural correlate of conscious access in primary visual cortex. Now, we wanted to do a causal manipulation. Can we knock out consciousness by inhibiting primary visual cortex? And we tried to do optogenetics in monkeys. We didn't find it easy. And this is just to show that you see the same effect in humans. So here we recorded single units from people with epilepsy, and you also see figure ground modulation. But we also see it in the mouse, and that's very convenient if you want to do optogenetics, because in that species it's actually quite easy. So this is the work of Lisa Kirchberger. We first had to train mice to look for figure ground stimuli. So there we trained them to lick to the left if there was a figure on the left, and lick to the right if there was a figure on the right. And we then use this very powerful optogenetic silencer called GTACR2, and we could just wipe out all the spikes from V1 of the mouse. Now, the nice thing about optogenetics is that it has a high temporal precision. So we could also let through the feedforward response, informing the higher areas that there is something going on in the visual stimulus, but blocking this late phase where you have this figure ground modulation. Right? Or we could also let through some of this late V1 phase. Now I'm just summarizing the data here. We also had a variant of the task where the mouse only had to detect the contrast, just like you were doing in the beginning. So no necessity for figure ground segregation. And what happened if we knocked out all the spikes from V1? Well, then the mouse was largely blind. He could not do either of the two tasks. If we let through the feedforward response, contrast perception was fine. They were as good as normal. But we selectively knocked out figure ground. Right, so I think this demonstrates that you need this late phase of V1 activity to be able to get the conscious perception in place. And only if you let through some of these late spikes, when you see this figure ground modulation, only then the mice could do figure grounds. Okay, so I think that's nice. So there's really some causal evidence then here that you need for this figure ground perception, this conscious perception of figure ground, you need late V1 activity. Okay, now this is the way you can think about it. You have feedforward connections, maybe kind of activating the local processors, and then you have feedback connections and perhaps also lateral connections that allow for recirculation of activity in the selection, the propagation of these selection signals. So that's what I proposed. I think that is what access awareness is about. And now I would like to elaborate a little bit more on this incremental grouping process. So I would invite you again to participate in this simple psychophysical experiment. I'm going to present two dots, and it's your task to tell me whether the dots are on the same object or on a different object. If you think they're on the same object, you might want to raise your left hand, or your left hand. And if it's on different objects, then raise your right hand. You might want to be just a bit faster than your neighbor. Okay? Are you ready for this? 1, 2, 3. Yeah, same. 1, 2, 3. Different. 1, 2, 3. Different again. 1, 2, 3. Okay, so now you can play this game many times. What we find is that the reaction time of subjects depend on the distance between the dots. So it increases if the dots are farther apart. And the way we were thinking about this you could think of a pixel by pixel model where you start with a cue, propagate enhanced activity, sort of consciousness, you might want to call it that, until it reaches the second dot, and then you're ready to respond. Right? So in this model, the time to respond is the distance between the dots as measured within the object. And in the second model, we considered that there are also larger receptive fields, so you can use V2, V4, or even IT receptive fields. Now, you might start in V1, but quickly realize that you can go to V4, and then you can make actually quite a lot of progress in the spreading process, because with a single synapse, you can cover much more space in V4 than in V1. But then if elements of the object become narrow, you might actually want to scale back to lower areas where you have more precision, smaller receptive fields. Okay, so that is what we call the growth cone model. Now, the growth cone model makes fast progress in large homogeneous image regions. And if you then look at human reaction times, we see that it's best predicted by the growth cone model, much better than the pixel by pixel model, suggesting that this is indeed a multi-scale process in the human brain. And we estimate the spreading speed, and we come with an estimate between 9 and 25 milliseconds per growth cone. Okay, so this is now what I'm proposing. So if you want to do this grouping, you have this propagation of enhanced activity through the object, and then it becomes part of your access awareness. Okay, now can we really measure this? So to test this, we implanted Utah arrays in the visual cortex of monkeys. This is what it looked like. So there's a pedestal with 16 Utah arrays connected to it. This is how we implanted them. This is the work of Paolo Papala, who will soon start his own lab in Italy. So we had 4 Utah arrays in V1, 2 in V4, or 3 in another monkey, and several arrays in IT cortex. Now we first looked at what is known as maximally exciting images. It's a way to kind of describe the tuning of the cells. This is multi-unit activity. So in V1, it doesn't really look like Jubilee Beetle, but you get the flavor. So you see that it looks like low-level features. In V4, we saw maximally exciting images that look a little bit more interesting, and this is IT cortex, so it looks like fluffy animals to me. So just to have a first impression. So now we're going to look at incremental grouping. So the monkeys saw a stimulus with 2 objects, a purple one that was cute and a green one that was sitting below. Then there were 2 targets, and now the task of the monkey was to make an eye movement from the fixation point, that's this red dot, to the target that is on the same object as the cue. Okay, and we recorded from V1, and we basically see the same effect as in figure ground. So first response is the feed-forward response, that is, hey, there's something purple in my receptive field that doesn't discriminate between the 2 situations. But if then the receptive field is on the target curve, as is the case in the top, you get more activity then, because here the monkey is tracing the green object, right? So then the activity is lower in the receptive field. So what's going on here? So these are receptive fields, 2 objects appear, V1 neurons start the response, and then the idea would be that through this global neuronal workspace, you get the propagation of enhanced activity, so that it becomes part of attention. Now here we're recording from different locations of the same curve, either the target or the destructor. And what we find is the first response, the initial response, is always triggered at the same time, right? It's just the delay between the retina and the cell in the visual cortex. But you see that here is this receptive field is close to the cue, and we get the response enhancement after 118 milliseconds. Here it's halfway, and you see the response enhancement after 189 milliseconds, and here it's towards the end of the curve, and the response enhancement after 38 milliseconds. So you really see this propagation of enhanced activity over the object. And the spread seems, our estimates are between 25 and 35 milliseconds per growth cone, so it's quite comparable. Actually, in human, we had 9 to 25, so I think 25 milliseconds is a good estimate. Now, we also varied the width of the curve according to the pixel-by-pixel model. It shouldn't matter whether a curve is thick or narrow. You go to the other side with the same speed. In the growth cone model, you go faster for thicker objects, right? And then you still need to go a bit longer for a thin object. So here we have curves of intermediate thicknesses. So this would be 1, 2, 3 growth cones, a latency of 161 milliseconds. Here it's the same Euclidean distance, but the object became thinner, so you need more growth cones. You get a longer latency. And if it's a thick curve, it's 1.5 growth cones, you get a shorter latency. Right, so this is a direct demonstration of this growth cone model. Okay, so we think that what you see here is the perceptual grouping is associated with the spread of enhanced activity, and the speed depends on the size of image components. And now I want to see whether this is also the case for everyday scenes. Right? I think actually this happens with every fixation that we make. You're doing a little bit of incremental grouping. So in the monkeys, we went to these artificial scenes of a forest, and we pasted a monkey and a crocodile. And so the monkeys were looking at the fixation point. Then there would be a cue, here cueing the monkey. 2 targets, and the task of the monkey would be to make an eye movement to the same object as the cue, right? So that would be the eye movement. It's easier to do it if there are outlines. These monkeys were overtrained. So here is the cue, 2 targets, and that's where you go. And so we recorded from V1 during this task, and so here's a receptive field close to the cue, latency of 121 milliseconds. Location 2, a bit farther along, and then it's 230 milliseconds. And then the surprise, at location 3, it was actually shorter than at location 2. So we are really kind of surprised by this. This is not how we predicted. Now, we made a post hoc explanation, and we said maybe what's going on here is that the monkey starts to trace, realizes, hey, this is a monkey. And in IT, there might be these monkey templates that then are going to feed back to all the monkey parts, right? And maybe the legs of the monkey are more monkey-like than the trunk of the monkey. I said it's not completely satisfactory at this stage. So maybe then you get first the enhancement here and then in the middle. So can we test that? So for that, we created cameras, because then you kind of break this possibility to use templates. So we used the monkodile and the cronky, and intermingle them with the monkey and the crocodile. Okay. And so this shows you example pictures. The monkey saw versions without the contours. Okay, and now things are normal again. So we get the earliest at position 1, it's 172. A little bit later at receptor field 2, 205 milliseconds. And even later at receptor field 3. So now, when we break those templates, then we see the normal sequential propagation as we expect. Okay, so I think that this is some evidence that that these higher order areas might indeed provide those shape templates, and these lateral connections are responsible for the lower level Gestalt grouping cues. And another way to break those templates is to show images that are upside down. So if you see the yellow cue, is it on the same object as the red or the green dots? It's difficult to see, right? It's easier to see if you show the picture normal, right? Now you see that the green is actually part of a suitcase and this is a shoe, okay? Now, we wanted to model this, and what we did is we have a network, this work of Simon Molar in the lab, making neural networks. So we're using UNet that does image segmentation as a backbone. And we work together with Thomas Serre, who has this gamma net that allows you to spread enhanced activity through a network. And this actually works. So you might notice that it actually briefly stops at the transition between the jacket and the t-shirt, but then it crosses. And this is how it works. So this first part of the backbone, the pyramid network, actually detects the boundaries between objects, but also some of the internal boundaries. And then this propagation network also uses semantic information and realizes that if the t-shirt and the jacket is actually part of the same human, it can work that out, and then it spreads throughout the entire human, which I find quite remarkable that this works. Okay, and here you see our network at work for an example image. And you see it starts spreading at the trousers, so brown stuff. And then eventually it also propagates into the face. And that is actually where I would like to say that this broadcast is not as in the TV, right? It starts knowing about brown and trouser stuff, but later it refines and it knows it's a human. So as this propagation continues, the information that can be incorporated becomes more refined. Okay, so I think this maps onto object-based attention. I would like to show that this propagation, this grouping, actually only happens for one object at any one time. And so this is a target object. It has two circles at the end, and this is a distractor. So I would like to invite you to find the target object in the next display. And you see it takes time, right? And you probably find yourself scrutinizing every pair of curves one at a time, because you cannot do this in parallel. So here is the one that is a target. Okay. Now, if I have 5 minutes left, Stan, is that okay? Three? Okay, so now I would like to, in 3 minutes, tell you a little bit about stuff that I'm excited about. So do you remember what I had the number that I gave in the beginning? So where was it all this time, right? It's probably not in access consciousness. Was it in phenomenal awareness? I don't know. You could debate about it. So this is how I'm thinking about memory. So if you attend something in memory, and then Li Ping Wang will also be talking about it. So you can attend something in working memory, and you can also have stuff in working memory that you do not attend. So I think that would be part of phenomenal awareness. Or something can be lost from memory, and then it's outside awareness. I'm going to skip this part. So what I want to propose is that if you think about memory networks, there's also the spread of activity, but now it spreads not between visual representations, but things in memory. And so this is how you can think of a conceptual network with all kinds of concepts. And I'm going to go very fast here to satisfy the time constraints. So Stan already presented this. So we see that if you have a pronoun, and so in this case, Barack Obama, Jennifer Anderson sat in the bar, and then the pronoun he refers to Barack, then you get a reactivation of the concept of Barack, right? That's what Stan talked about in his first short presentation. So the way I'm thinking about this is now is that you have Barack Obama, and there's still a trace of Barack. So somewhere in working memory, it's still there. Even if Jennifer Aniston is already presented, you see that Barack cell in IT cortex, or in the hippocampus, actually it was, is not active anymore. And then there's the word he, right? And that might spread then to male concepts, and from there then to Obama. So that's what I think that is sort of what the global neuron workspace does for you if you talk about more conceptual memory codes. And one prediction, and then I'm done, so is that this spread should be blocked if the global neuron workspace is occupied with something else. So we train subjects to make associations between concepts. So they trained that Beyoncé and Greta Thunberg, that they are associated, Oprah Winfrey and Ed Sheeran, that they were a pair, and Dolly Parton and Cristiano Ronaldo, they were a pair. And so we did a PRP task in which the subjects in the first task had to judge whether a tone had a high or a low pitch. And then one of these pictures appeared, or other ones, so this is the picture of Beyoncé. Then the subject had to retrieve the associated concept with what Greta Thunberg, and then press on the left side, because the first letter in the name of Greta was on the left. So it's a very complicated task. And we got the expected PRP effect. So if you're doing the tone task, you're not making any progress on this association task. And this is how you can think about it. So you have a picture of Beyoncé, you activate the concept Beyoncé, then you have to retrieve Greta, search for a G, and then respond. Now, where does this delay occur? And we found it out when we recorded from these concept cells. So this is the response in the hippocampus, medial temporal lobe, to the visible picture. And you see that the response to the associated picture happens later, about 400 milliseconds later. And this is when the picture is neither the shown or the associated picture. Now, if you look at the influence of the other task, task one, on the activation of the concept by the visible picture, there's no influence, hardly any influence. But to retrieve the association, you get this huge delay that actually completely accounts for the PRP effect, right? So we now found where this problem occurs. So apparently during the PRP, you cannot spread activity from one concept to another concept that are linked through an association. Okay, so this is what we did. We linked Dolly to Cristiano, Beyoncé to Greta. Oh. Then you activate Beyoncé. That doesn't matter if there's another task ongoing. So if you show a picture, this concept will get activated. But to spread to Greta, for that you need a global neuron workspace. Okay? So I would like to propose then that global neuron workspace in memory corresponds to attention, the things that you're attending in working memory. You need to use that to retrieve associations and for pronoun resolution. In the perception, I don't need to repeat that. So I think that would be a sort of a refinement of the ideas about the global neuronal workspace. And generally, I think that the philosophy of consciousness maps very well into perceptual psychology. So access consciousness is what you attend, and phenomenal consciousness are the things that are there, are accessible. And if it's not accessible, then it's not conscious. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.